one day I was round at his studio doing something for a comedy program that he was making, and I noticed that there were gold discs on the wall, and I said, oh, that's interesting, you've got a gold disc of Viva Hate, you know, that's have you got that? And Andrew said something like, yes, well, you know, when you've drummed for Morrissey, you know, one wants to remember it. And I laughed and he said, I have drummed for Morrissey. I said, no, you haven't. He said, yes, I have. I was Morrissey's drummer. And I said, what do you mean you were Morrissey's drummer? I mean, this seemed like somebody saying to me, you know, I was the fifth member of the Beatles. It seemed like such an insane thing to have been. And then, of course, I looked around and realised that the other things in the studio were a drum kit, which should have been a giveaway, and a bunch of gold discs that were indeed the Morrissey solo albums.
That was Observer film critic Mark Kermode talking about drumming. My drumming. That's right. I'm Andrew McGibbon, though some of you may know me as Andrew Peresi. A few of you may not have heard of me before, and most of you don't know who I am anyway. This is my story. Of course, I could have written 100,000 words, crammed them into a paperback, and you could have bought it at an airport somewhere. But once I'd set it down, it only came to 28 minutes. The classic single Every Day Is Like Sunday by Morrissey, singer with 80s band The Smiths. But have you ever wondered what's underneath the mix? Follow me. Buried deep inside this tunnel is an integral part of... Well, I wonder where that had gone. Yes, underneath the densely layered beauty that is a Morrissey song, you'll find this. It's called Cheese Cheer, or Solar Phlegm in the music business, but you and I know it as drumming. Here's what some important people in the music industry think about drummers. British national treasure, Suggs.
They're the least intelligent of the group, obviously, because they bash their brains out. And they like to spend hours and hours going boom, 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 individually on the drums before the rest of the band arrive, before the rest of the band are even in the same country. And they get on better with the road crew than everyone else because they're on the same intellectual level.
Here's Coldplay's producer, Danton Supple.
I guess they're kind of a bit like lab rats in lots of ways. We can give them some input and record the results. Sometimes it's entertaining.
Ex-music journalist David Quantick.
Drummers are weird because they call themselves musicians, and they do play an instrument, but it's not an instrument that goes janga, 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 readily doody doo. It doesn't play a tune. So the thing is, at a party, a bit of guitar is nice, bit of flute. If someone starts doing that, you know, that someone's mum will come in and go, will you stop that?
And legendary record producer Clive Langer.
What do you think of drummers?
That's my response.
You've nothing to say?
No.
Okay.
To really understand what motivated me to play the drums, we have to go right back, almost to the beginning. I first picked up the drumsticks at the age of 16. Give them back here.
No!
Well, I practiced and practiced and practiced until I was red in the face. But the big flesh doors of destiny parted very slowly and actually got jammed at one point. I worked in run-down bars, seedy shopping malls and a big hotel near the airport. And it was late one evening in exactly this place, New Year's Eve to be precise, when a man approached me and asked me to come up to his bedroom and play bongos while he seduced a call girl before returning to his wives in the Middle East. Seeing an opportunity to advance my percussion skills, I jumped at the two £50 notes he was dangling, kept my acetate shirt and safari suit firmly on, and agreed to be part of the evening's entertainment. Having lost my job at the hotel, I was thrown onto the pointy shards of uncertainty. Homeless for 6 months, I slept on prostitutes' floors, sometimes even on prostitutes, often being mistaken for clients who hadn't paid. Then, in the mid-80s, it all changed. Yes, in the sparkling 80s, everything was shiny and sparkly and people wore big spectacles, rainbow T-shirts and leg warmers. Back then, sartorial dullness was a crime on a parallel with animal buggery. So I did my best, but frankly, I didn't really cut it. I wore bright trousers, wanky shoes, and loose-fitting, ridiculous baggy jumpers that made me look like Giles Brandreth's stylist. David Quantick was there. He remembers.
Around about 81 had been a really good time for music, because you'd had people like the Human League and ABC, and even old Adam and his aunts were quite good at this point. But all of that has sort of gone away, and you were left with a really quite dull pop scene. And it was just when CD corporate pop had come in. I think Dire Straits were at their height. That was people's idea of a good group.
Nevertheless, this sad environment was my musical nest. And I was busy warming a clutch of soulless ambitions, conning myself into thinking I was only a few years away from becoming a successful muso star, with permed hair, fake tan, Afghan hound, house in Crystal Palace, and ex-backing singer wife. But something profound was about to happen to me. There were two obsessions in the 80s. One was certain annihilation by a nuclear weapon. The other was Buck's Fizz.
Buck's Fizz were a perfectly acceptable second-rate pop group who were a kind of ABBA for the dead. A sort of one down from Dollar, really.
Yes, I drummed on the first song ever to be recorded by Buck's Fizz about nuclear war.
All our generation, we were all going to die. We'd had all that Frankie nonsense, protect and survive, this, by the time you hear this whistle, you'll all be dead, or whatever it was. But basically, the world was obsessed with death. Death through nuclear war.
We got very involved with CND, and I remember marching around Trafalgar Square, and Michael Heseltine had a load of loudspeakers out of his apartment playing military marching music, and he was shouting out of a loud hearing, going, "This is real marching music, you hear me, you long-edged jobbers!" What a disorientating sight that was for him.
Thank you, Suggs. But back in the thick, dark bush of popular music, things were stirring.
Your indie student rock fan felt a bit disenfranchised. There was nobody miserable and dirty that he could like. A Billy Bragg was all right, but he was a bit political. And REM were all right, but they were a bit American. And then suddenly the Smiths came along. And they were this extraordinary mixture of glamorous, with all the fainness and the gladioli and the gay lyrics, and miserable, this bizarre combination of Oscar Wilde and Victoria Wood. It was all very exciting.
If you found Morrissey funny, then the Smiths were a really great band. And the people who hate the Smiths and hated Morrissey later on were people who never found any of that stuff funny. I mean, I was always really charmed by anyone, you know, writing songs about, you know, "Oh, everything's awful, my life's terrible, no one loves me, oh, and I woke up this morning and I was still here and I was still me and you're not here and you threw me out of bed, oh," because to me that's really funny. But equally, I understand people that listen to that and go, "Shut up, you whinging ninny."
Smiths fan Mark Kermode. Here's Suggs.
My first contact with Morrissey actually was on Top of the Pops, which is always a strange environment. I do remember I was standing on stage, we were doing Night Boat to Cairo in a pith helmet in khaki shorts, and on the other stage was Morrissey singing Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, and Dexys Midnight Runners were doing Gino. So I suddenly had this terribly disorientating feeling of being a sort of children's entertainer at a at a very serious party that, you know, I was being ignored at from.
Meanwhile, I tried to capitalise on the excellent drumming I'd done by working for 2 years in an old people's home in Westbourne Grove.
Are you there? Are you there?
Of course I played around. Well, I was a musician, for heaven's sake. In fact, I was the only brown-eyed member of a blue-eyed soul band whose first single was being mixed by Smith's producer, Stephen Street.
I remember working on the track and being very impressed with, you know, with the drumming on it.
Stop it. Stephen asked me to drum on Viva Hate, the first solo album by Morrissey. I hadn't heard of him before, so turned it down to take up a post with the Baron Knights touring band. Next week, I'll be looking at the influence of the Medici family in Renaissance Florence and how its impact still reverberates today, even if the family don't. Only kidding. Of course I took the job.
At the end of the summer of 87, when the Smiths had broken up, I had sent off this cassette to Morrissey with some ideas I thought could be used for B-sides for forthcoming Smith singles. And he sent me a postcard back saying, you know, "I want to make an album." So I met him and I said, "What do we do now?" He said, "Well, I want to do it. Have you got any idea who we could work with?" So I said, "Well, I've got a drummer in mind I think could do a really fine job on the record. Would you like me to arrange a meeting?"
I still wasn't sure why I'd been picked from the thousands who were never auditioned. One thing was certain. I'd been chosen for my drumming, not my appearance, as I dressed like a sack of shit. So I was tidied up and presented to Morrissey at Stephen Street's flat. This dazzlingly symmetrical chompster sporting tumescent quiff and limpid NHS specs was the most beautiful creature I'd ever seen since squashing a fledgling sparrow under my chopper in the 70s.
I mean, it was very hard to think of, you know, the right kind of people to put in the studio with Morrissey, because he's very particular. You know, if he doesn't like you, he'll just completely blank you. So it was very, very important I chose the people carefully to come and help me make the first record.
And so I'd become Morrissey's drummer. Of course, saying I was Morrissey's drummer is a little bit like saying I was Jack Ruby's tailor, or I was Tiger Woods' caddy, or I was Michael Rodd's nipple greaser. The truth is, you're simply travelling with greatness and putting its cat out at night. I was a hired hand, there to channel the spirits of rhythm into the pools of tune and bond them into a seamless mesh of hum-hash. My compadres were Durruti Column guitarist Vinnie Riley and producer Stephen Street, who wrote the music.
I would play the rough demo of it to Andrew and Vinnie, give Vinnie the chords, go downstairs, play bass while Vinnie was playing guitar and Andrew was playing drums, put the track down, and then you put his vocal on and you go, now we know what's going to happen on it.
Early on, I decided the best approach was to have a clear drum composition for each song and really think about what kind of playing would fire up and complement the track. Failing that, I just played any old toss.
The first single, Suede Head, was extraordinary. It sounded like the Smiths and it didn't sound like the Smiths. Fantastic guitar riff, and it really sounded like a development, a step on.
The top line that comes on there is a Vinnie Riley riff. Could have been suggested by the drum fill, that dut-dut-dut thing. I don't know, because obviously that picks up on the same beat in the bar. But, I mean, the reason why I love Suede Head so much is because I think actually it was the first one we cut in the studio where I thought the contributions from both Vinnie and Andrew were spot on, and it made that track come alive.
Every Day is Like Sunday. Great tune, great lyric, nicked off John Betjeman, obviously. But what I particularly like about it, given Morrissey's hatred of anything that likeable, is the fact it's his attempt to do a New Order record. It's got that beautiful sort of droning bass and those little changes, and it could just about fit into sort of mid-period New Order. So it's a Manchester classic in many ways.
Well, Every Day's Like Sunday is a great pop record, just because, again, it's Morrissey doing that classic, you know, drop an atom bomb on this horrible English seaside town and wet sand, and it's got that big, romping, apocalyptic feel to it, and it's a classic post-Smiths Morrissey pop song. It's big, it's aware of its own ridiculousness. It's ironic because Every Day is Like Sunday, which is meant to be an upbeat thing, but in fact it's Every Day is Like Sunday because every day is silent and grey, everything is miserable, everything is awful. Oh, no one still loves me, oh, everything is still grim and terrible. With Suede Head and with Every Day is Like Sunday, they are classic air drumming tracks, because Every Day is Like Sunday starts with that dun 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 dun, and you're sitting there in the kitchen waving your arms around dun 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 like that. And then Suede Head, because it's got that sort of backwards guitar bit at the beginning, then dun dun dun. I have air drummed to those songs on several occasions.
Mark Kermode, or was that David Quantick? No, this is David Quantick.
I'm very fond of Disappointed because it's got an interesting rhythm.
Shall I play it for you, David?
That would be nice.
Yeah, OK.
Nice, because it's kind of tribal, sort of glitter band upside down.
Late Night Magdalene Street came out of the second batch of songs. The style of drumming on that to work would have to be more, say, American, kind of jazzy, rather than, you know, like kind of Brit pop type drumming. So it was perfect.
The place where they wanted the drumming to come in occurred at a point in the song's narrative where life was changing dramatically, darling. This is what I decided to do. When the instrumental verse came in, I played a very loose double-time samba with a variety of fills and cross-rhythms, backed up with eights pedalled on the hi-hat and very occasionally the bass drum accenting cymbals and firing the occasional demi-semis. I used a lot of five-stroke rolls, odd accents and grace notes, with the fills standing out in an angular way so as to underscore the emotions in the song.
I mean, things that we were doing that first album, I can remember sometimes people playing charades, you know, in the cottage. I mean, you never saw him playing charades with the Smiths. It was like, you know, they'd be getting absolutely bollocked somewhere and, you know, he'd be in bed, but, you know, it was very English, and he enjoyed it. I think we gave him a definite rock to cling to in those post-Smiths traumatic months that he must have gone through.
The launch party for Viva Hate took place in a seedy nightclub in Bath. Stephen Street forced me to wear his denim jacket and put the rest of my outfit in a lime bath.
Well, I think Morrissey kind of said, I wouldn't be seen dead with Andrew looking like that. If he's coming out with us tonight, he's going to have to look a little sharper than that. So he didn't say it as such, but you could just tell by the look, you know? So I was like, Andrew, have you thought about wearing this jacket, you know?
Normally, launch parties are supposed to be roaring affairs, but this was so quiet, many punters thought the club was closed for redecoration. To know that I had the drumming chair for an entire album and the freedom to experiment with expressive and different styles was a double joy. I felt unassailable and relieved. There would be no muscled knobhead barging his way onto my throne and cracking jokes at everyone in the band laughed at. I knew that no other drummer could make me redundant. Only Morrissey could do that. So he did.
Morrissey, a couple of months later, wrote to me and said, I want to do another session. I've chosen these tracks that you know that you've sent me. I'd like to work on those. He said, however, I would like to work with Mike and Andy. Andy Rourke, that is, and Mike Joyce, the original Smiths rhythm section. Have you any problem with that? I said, no, absolutely not at all.
Thank you very much. I bummed around a bit again for about 18 months. In that time, I came close to losing my flat. I had no choice but to sell my drum kit to pay the mortgage. The next day, I was hired to play with Morrissey again.
Then you had the great Morrissey album that never was, Boner Drag, which ended up being an album called Boner Drag, which was bits of the album that was going to be Boner Drag, with some other tracks which weren't on Boner Drag, but were. It was all very confusing, and no one cared.
The new producers, Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley, were serious heavyweights, and I didn't want to give the impression that I wasn't a proper professional. But I did anyway, and turned up at the session with a drum kit that would have shamed a primary school. In spite of this woeful professional lapse on my part, I was allowed to stay and make some new friends, like Andy Rourke, bass player with the Smiths.
You see Morrissey and then you expect next to see Johnny and then Mike and then, yeah, to come in and see, you know, a room full of strangers. So everybody was kind of a little bit nervous and twitchy.
Hookend Manor was quite a place, a perfect rock and roll haunt. Def Leppard and Guns N' Roses had been in there a week before, and while they were there, it was all-night parties, eager rock chicks and plenty of fornication. As soon as Morrissey and his band arrived, however, it turned into a Jesuit retreat, complete with vegetarian chef deacon, a Catholic priest in the control room, and plenty of fornication. Suggs was there too.
I was invited down there by Clive, who was producing the record, and had said Morrissey was a fan of Madness and would like to meet me. And that was it, really. We had a rather stilted introduction in a public house, of course, because Moz was a big fan of pubs. Then we had a punch-up and a game of darts, which was nice. he was rather shy, as I am most of the time, but it soon warmed up, and the idea was mooted that I might go and sing on a couple of the tracks that had been recorded.
Producer Clive Langer.
He gave us loads of freedom, but without knowledge of what we were doing. We were free to do whatever we wanted, but he didn't define what was happening until he did his vocal. And then you weren't really allowed to mess with it too much afterwards. So there was a bit of freedom, and it was structured, and we wanted to impress Mr. Morrissey when he came down for his tea, you know.
I went to his room once when we were at Hook End, and I went up to his room, knocked on the door, and I could hear this tap, 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 tap. When all the lights were off, the curtains were drawn, and he was going around the room with a blind stick. Now, what would you put that down to? I don't know. Yes, I am blind.
November Spawn and Monster is a song that at the time I was mildly irritated by, possibly because of Mary Margaret O'Hara's very frightening fit in the middle, but it's actually grown on me because it did seem a genuine attempt by Morrissey to do something that was not just about him showing off. It was an attempt by him to make a musically interesting record and to say something, which of course being Morrissey, you had no idea what it was. So yeah, very interesting record, and of course, great drumming.
I think Morrissey used to talk about a mood he wanted for a song, and I'd go off and have a little go. He would reject some of the tunes that I thought were the strongest. That was Morrissey's way. I always gave in to whatever he wanted. And, you know, with November Spawned a Monster, the part I thought was a chorus, he would make into a verse, etc. So he'd change your whole outlook in the process of him writing.
Bass-wise, it's one of the ones I'm most proud of, really. It's just a really great song.
You know, November is obviously my proudest moment with him.
Suggs there, followed by Clive... No, wait a minute, Clive Langer, And before that, Suggs and Andy Rourke. Well, here's Andy Rourke with a story about Kevin Armstrong, the guitarist, who played on this. He's great.
I used to sleep in the room next to him. And every morning about 6 o'clock, because he was a Buddhist, wasn't he? And he used to start chanting and dinging these bells. And I was like, I wanted to strangle him every morning. It was worse than hearing, you know, the cocking of the crow every morning.
You know, when you work with Morrissey, he kind of becomes your wife. And so you have to give up other parts of your life, and then you make the decision whether that's worth it or not. For me, it was worth it, and I felt a lot of love for him, but I never depended on him for anything. You know, I mean, it's that kind of, it's a weird love.
The highlight of the day was always the meal time when everybody, it was like the Last Supper every night, and Morrissey would sit at the head of the table, and nobody would eat until Morrissey started eating and stuff like that. Nobody had tapped the wine until Morrissey had tasted it. It was quite amusing.
The Last Supper, because so often it was the Last Supper, yeah. Wasn't it? Like, one minute there'd be someone on the other side of the table, a guitarist who'd done really well.
And then they'd be gone.
They'd be gone.
Yeah. He'd wake up and go, oh, just gone to speak to so-and-so in the room. And where's his case? Oh, he's gone. Oh. He's been sent away.
Yeah, there are more people disappeared under Morrissey than the Pinochet's.
It's like the fog.
One morning, having had a fitful night's sleep, delirious, hallucinating and tormented by feelings of self-harm, I confronted Morrissey about how wounded I'd been by his decision to use Smith's drummer Mike Joyce on the previous two singles. Morrissey always rose early for breakfast and, expecting to have the dawn chorus for company, found himself being talked to death by a sugar-crazed backbeater vomiting a fountain of hurt. In the face of my stinging early morning outburst, he was an absolute gentleman, and a personal connection was made between us, one that survived beyond the Kill Uncle sessions of 1990.
I reviewed Kill Uncle for the NME, and I actually really liked it. There was an attempt to do a pop record. It was quite a good idea at the time, having done the guitar-y stuff, that he would get in Mark Nevin and Langer and Winstanley, so Fairground Attraction and Madness. You know, pretty good antecedents, very British as well.
David Quantick. One of the key elements of the Kill Uncle recording sessions was my desire to contribute drumming to as many songs as possible. That way I felt I made more money.
Yeah, I think Sing Your Life's a lovely song. And, you know, it's one of those songs where you think, was that written about me? As you so often do, being as egotistical as what we are in this industry, most of us. Because it was a nice, the sentiment of it was that anyone can sing, as long as you sing in your own voice and you sing about the things you understand, which is something that was very important to me as an artist in my own career. I just remember we sort of did a vaguely sort of yobbish chorus, possibly a drink or two, a crowd sequence, and I think it turned out very, very well.
But there's a song there called Mute Witness, which is extraordinary. I remember the press officer playing it to me. It sounded like Sparks or early Roxy music. Really quite a mad tune. And I was excited by that record because I thought that it would be a new direction for Morrissey.
It was like we just created a book of poetry with music behind it for Kill Uncle, and I was very proud of that. It was a pity that the Happy Mondays and all that stuff was happening at the same time, because we didn't get a look in. They were on a fashion elevator, and we were just making a record.
Yeah. Clive Langer, and before that, David Quantick. Having finished drumming on Morrissey's new single My Love Life, the boys in the band and I headed off to the Camden Working Men's Social Club for an evening of rockabilly pride and Celtic hover skittles. Once inside, surrounded by quiffed and tattooed bopsters, some of whom would go on to become future band members, Morrissey leant back on the wall and told me that he was in heaven and that he completely belonged here and that this was where he'd always wanted to be and that these were his people and that this... I forget exactly what he said, but at that moment, I knew I was fired. Come on to my house. The revolving doors of fortune began to disgorge the quiffless casualties of change.
I mean, at the end of the session, I just had a feeling that he wasn't going to sort of carry on, and plus I no longer had a rockabilly hairdo, so...
I was in, I was out. You know, that's the way Morrissey works.
The real sign of quality for a Morrissey musician, by the way, isn't quality, it's quantity. It's the fact that you're actually there on more than one record. If there was a graph of Morrissey musicianship, it would be based on tenure. And I think Andrew managed to hold on to his post a lot more than many other people did.
After that, I took a sabbatical from drumming to concentrate on writing comedy. which might explain why I'm back drumming again. Stephen Street.
I think with Andrew's sense of humour, it really did help keep the session flowing in the sense that, you know, if you can make Morrissey chuckle and have a laugh, then that really helps quite a lot. It really does.
Danton Supple.
What you do get is a whole host of voices, and so when the talkback goes down, you never really know what character's going to come singing back from the drum kit.
Andy Rourke.
It was like Michael Bentine's potty time every day. There's lots of funny jokes and little witty comments coming all the time.
Plus, there's a certain aesthetic comedy as well, really. If you actually ever watch Andrew playing, it's always this pained, wide-mouth expression from the moment that this track starts to the end. But, no, he was very, very funny.
Mark Kermode.
I had known Andrew largely as Major Holdups on Radio 1, because I was a film critic on Radio 1, and Andrew used to do this comedy act called Major Holdups, in which he would do the travel information in the voice of an English Spitfire pilot.
Something is jamming our frequency. Get off this frequency, will you? Who's that?
Who am I talking to?
Major Holdups, you gibbering clot.
Hold on a minute, there's two of you now. You might want to get that radio looked at, Major.
There's nothing wrong with my radio. It's top of the range. I think I may be able to offer an explanation, 1-5.
Here's what some customers have to say about my product.
Andrew's drumming is great. He can do so many different styles. I think for Morrissey, he was on that album, he was a rock drummer, but he'll then surprise you with a sudden jazz moment. And he's just a very flexible, very talented drummer.
He was very good, very solid. Pulled some great facial expressions as he whacked the snare, and yeah, like he meant it. I'm speaking like his dad. He's actually still here, isn't he?
What do you think of Andrew's drumming?
Shit. Oh, his drumming's, his paradiddles are a bit soft.
Clive Langer, joking there, of course. But no doubt some of you are thinking, has Andrew still got it? Does he still have that intimate connection with the universal rhythm of life, the ineffable beating of nature? Well, let me set you right on that, Mrs. Miniver of Limpley Stoke. Just listen to this.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously this isn't my kit, you know, and the bass drum's not right, so, okay. Yeah, I mean, you can't just expect me to come in and play. I mean, it's not that straightforward. I mean, I've got to practice. I'll tell you, let me play some jazz, because that's really... I'm usually very good with military drumming. Yeah, left hand down, isn't it? I've done this loads of times. Rubbish!